Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and I am so delighted to be joined today by Rebecca Mackay. Her last novel, The Great Believers, was a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Her other books are the novels The Borrower and The 100-Year House and the collection Music for Wartime. A 2022 Guggenheim Fellow, Rebecca is on the MFA faculties of the University of Nevada, Reno at Lake Tahoe and Northwestern University, and is Artistic Director of Story Studio Chicago. Her latest book is called I Have Some Questions for You. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you so much.
This is a little awkward, actually, because the book I'm trying to write is maybe the nonfiction version of this really wonderful novel that you wrote, the theme of which I'd like to call the You're Wrong About Industrial Complex, where it's not just like Me Too was a moment when women looked back on their lives and realized that some of the things we took as normal and just what happened was not okay at all.
Yeah.
I'm just about the same age as you are, and I feel like that about all of the 90s. Like, yeah. Everything we were taught was, there was a problem with most of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. And I think, you know, I'm in my 40s. I think it's a logical age to look back with distance. Yeah. At your adolescence, you know, for not everyone, but a lot of us, we have kids now. And so you're thinking about their childhood, you're thinking about your own. And there's just enough distance where you're like, wow, things are different. To be clear, it's not like everyone has everything figured out right now.
No.
When you say something, you know, because like if you talk to like a 20-year-old, they're like, yes, it was so like the dark ages, but now we know. Like they feel like, you know, like we thought we did. They feel like this is it. This is the point of arrival. And no one, you know, now it's this point of great moral virtue. And you're like, oh God, you're going to be so embarrassed in 20 years because
we're all taught to think that we're post.
Oh, yeah. Right. And it's really like, it's one thing to look back and be like, yeah, we were wrong 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's another thing for people, especially young people who just have not been through this cycle or this evolution, to be like, yeah, and we're probably not there now either. So it was fun. Yeah, it was fun to explore that in fiction.
And of course, I love that one of the ways you explore this is a la You Must Remember This, Karina Longworth. Or you're wrong about a heroine named Bodhi who hosts her own podcast about actresses that you might have been wrong about.
Yeah. No, it's funny. Those are two podcasts that I absolutely love, both of those. And, you know, certainly she's her own thing. My character has this podcast called Starlit Fever, and it's very specifically about the ways women were abused in early Hollywood. And it's something that it's kind of like the podcast that I want to listen to. I'm not sure it exactly exists. It's like that's certainly the topic that some podcasts occasionally get into, but it's the thing I want to read like 7 books about. So, you know, I'm not going to necessarily write that book myself, although God, that would be really fun to write a book about early Hollywood. But it was, you know, you pick out a career for a character. I think that matters hugely. Like, I don't love it when books are just give someone like a really vague job, some kind of office something. And I also like, I don't think there are enough books where people love their jobs.
Yeah.
You know, it's always the like the thing that's crushing your soul versus real life. And especially books where women love their jobs, and it's specifically movies that do this, but the like, you know, anytime a woman has a significant career, it's always in opposition to a love life, a family life, you know, it's always something that she has to learn to take less seriously. And I hate that. So I, you know, had a lot of fun writing about someone who really is really into what she does.
I this is a good segue into a part of the book that I really enjoyed and that I've heard about this kind of phenomenon from so many different moms who are authors.
Mm-hmm.
That if you're out about in the world promoting your book, or if in Bodhi's case, it's her podcast, She often gets the question of who's watching her children while she's out there promoting this.
Yeah, it's constant. It's amazing. I started to notice it specifically, it became very stark for me before my last book, The Great Believers, came out. There were four of us who went together for 1 week on a pre-publication tour where we were like in a different city every night meeting with booksellers. And there were two men and two women. And all of us were parents. One of these guys actually had five kids. And every single night, just in these kind of cocktail party mixing, you know, with like journalists, booksellers, people like that, the two women, we would get constantly asked, oh my, so who's watching your kids while you're doing this? And no one's ever asking the men this. It's, I guess, you know, I'm not usually on tour with guys. You know, it's more like I'm on tour by myself. So it was specifically that contrast that was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Of course, we know that women, you know, are constantly getting asked, how do you balance being a mom, being a writer? And it was driving me nuts, always, but there's a news story I'm following right now in England, this woman who went missing very suddenly. And she has some like pretty serious job. Every single article is like, blah, 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 mom goes missing. This mom of two. You don't do that with men. It's infuriating. Like, you might have a high power career. You might be on a book tour. You might be whatever this woman in England did. It sounded like really, you know, serious thing, but that's not the important part. The important part is you're a mom and where are your kids?
And I even noticed, Rebecca, that it feels very deliberate that Bodhi spends very little time talking about her two children.
Yeah. She the book takes place, there are two different kind of windows of time when the book takes place. And in both of them, she's in New Hampshire, whereas she lives in LA, and that's where her ex-husband is. That's where her kids are. So we're with her in times when she is away from home. And she certainly, you know, she talks to her kids on FaceTime, she thinks about them, but my experience, and you know, like I love being a mom, but my experience is that when I'm out there, when I'm working, when I'm traveling, I am not sitting there being like, oh, my children, where are my children? Like I am my own person and I'm doing what I'm doing. And then, you know, we call once in a while. And I just wanted to basically replicate that. It's not that I was trying to make some statement that's not true to me or to other women who I know. I was just trying to be realistic about that. Like, yeah, she's, you know, she's busy with other stuff.
She's got like, a lot going on.
Yeah.
And so let's talk a little bit about what she has going on.
Yeah.
So she's invited back to this boarding school where she attended as a scholarship student. I like in your author's note at the end, you're very careful to say you did go to a boarding school.
Yeah, but not anything like the one I'm writing about. Yeah, I was a day student at a boarding school.
And Bodhi is asked to come back for this 2-week intercession kind of specialty course. And so she's going to teach a bunch of high schoolers about film and podcasting, which that sounds fun. But another thing about Bodhi's time at Rambi is that the student who she shared a room with junior year was murdered in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about podcasts, Serial really did change the game in terms of involving regular people in a matter that might not concern them. And showing people that it can count.
Yeah. It was also the first podcast most of us listened to, I think. For me,
think
it was
right.
Like, wait, everyone's talking about this. How do I get podcasts? And like finding that app on my phone and going, oh, okay. Yeah, it was definitely kind of the OG in terms of podcasting medium for true crime coverage. Although, like, you know, you look at, and, you know, you look, oh my God, the way that murder trials were covered in the 1920s, the like lurid details, the way people would go and like souvenir collect at crime scenes. And then we look at like, you know, Dateline in the 80s, 90s, aughts, like this is nothing new, but it was definitely, you know, the original kind of, you know, the podcast that got that going. And I think it's the reason that so many podcasts are true crime podcasts is people just realized that there was something about the storytelling that could go on in a podcast that really suited the medium. You know, there are great things about Serial. There are things that I think it did not do very well. And it took credit for things that it shouldn't have taken credit for in the end. But, you know, yeah, I listened to that one. I've listened to a lot of other ones. But beyond that, I mean, I'm just someone who will do a major deep dive online into a case that captures my attention. I do once in a while, like on Twitter, I'll post ones where, like, especially I don't ever want to do something with like living people, even in my limited Twitter reach. So I'm always getting into like unsolved murders from the 1920s or 30s, which is a time period I love anyway. But, you know, I was interested in, you know, exploring, you know, a big theme of the book is who's, you know, who gets to own the story. And certainly, you know, there are imbalances of race and class and gender and power in terms of who gets to own the story. But there's also this question of, you know, what happens when a story captures the public imagination? What happens when a story gets out on the internet and you have people with YouTube channels devoted to a case when they had no connection to it? There's good stuff that can come of that, right? Like the freeing of the West Memphis Three. There's, you know, people can recognize, like, you know, submit familial DNA and solve cases, or they recognize photos that have been posted of Jane Doe's. So there is absolutely good that can come of that and pushing for Innocence Project work. But there's this really skeezy side to it too. That has been there all along, obviously, but there's, you know, it's just there. And so I wanted to include that.
Yeah, I think that any time we're talking about a true case of violent crime, we're in a way that's captivating, we're kind of consuming the worst moment of a life or a few lives as entertainment. And that is not great.
Yeah.
Yet.
Right. Well, I think there's something evolutionary, there's something instinctual where, like, you know, I'm sure for like most of human history, it's like, oh, that guy died. How did he die? I need to learn. So like, oh, he ate those berries, or he like fell off that cliff.
Right.
I got to check that out so that I don't do that, you know, and it's, you know, usually not that helpful. And, you know, sometimes you learn things about like that kind of person not to date. There are times where like, okay, I'm going to just make a note of that. But we often don't even know why we're drawn in. We just are. I do think it's instinctual. I do think it's evolutionary. But even when it's like, well, this is clearly not going to happen to you. This is something, but I think that's a reason that we're so often drawn to cases where there's some connection, right? Someone maybe lived in the same city as us, or we knew someone who knew them, or they have, you know, they have a job like our job, or whatever it is, where we don't even know why we're drawn to certain cases. But then if you actually look at anyone's personal kind of file folder of like the cases they've been obsessed with, you could probably figure out a lot about who that person is by the things they get drawn in by, the things they're disturbed by, the things they can't look away from. It's probably because they feel like some connection to their own life.
And, you know, Bodhi is a perfect example of such a person. And I even like that the kinds of pushback she gets is very much a part of this process of figuring out, okay, is she going to make this podcast or oversee this podcast that her students are going to make about the murder of her former roommate? And is it their right? Is it her right? Who has the right to tell such a story? And does she just have a white savior complex?
Right. Yeah, that's a big part of it. And it's like, well, and or do her, you know, just her one student is very, you know, very concerned about that. Like, do I have the right to even investigate this? And what if it's a white savior complex? But then it's like, well, but someone needs to, you like, also don't just not do it because you feel like, oh, I can't possibly. So, you know, good actually does come about to a certain extent from these people's involvement in this case, but it's messy. It's really, really
very messy. And of course you have the family members who were happy to have a resolution and don't necessarily want to open that part of their life again.
Right. Yeah.
But also there's a man in prison.
Yeah, there are a couple of different reasons that it's almost impossible to not only to overturn a conviction, but even to get to the point of a retrial One of them is that prosecutors do not want to lose the convictions that they've like chalked up to wins. Judges don't, you know,
sure,
a jurisdiction doesn't want to like then have an unsolved case. Police don't want to back down. And the other part of it is that the families want that to be done. They've, you know, whether they're correct or incorrect, have found peace by feeling like, okay, the chapter's closed, this guy is in prison. And to either suggest that, you know, to suggest that this person could get out on what they might see as a technicality could be terrifying, or to suggest that all the peace they've found is false would be terrifying in a different way. And so you very seldom get a family going, yeah, that guy should really like, let's you know,
let's take a look at
the trial. Let's check that evidence out again. It makes sense, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about Prank in this book. I remember Ruman Alam blurbed this book and I talked to him about kind of learning how to write the beats of a quote unquote unputdownable thriller.
Yeah. You know, yeah, it's I would love for any book that I write to have those beats, right?
Sure.
And also, like I'm really easily bored. I have pretty intense ADHD, and just, you know, the books that are like beautifully written but not much happens, they're not for me. There are people who will eat those up. I'm just not one of them. I'm also not a reader of things that are just kind of surface level thriller, like boom, 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 oh my God, the car exploded. That's not my jam either. So, you know, like I love a ton of French, right? On the kind of way plottier end of what I read. It's really smart. It's really, there's deep psychology going on in those books. You know, I taught elementary school for 12 years. I taught Montessori elementary school. And I read aloud to those kids for half an hour every day, just like The Westing Game or like Lois Lowry or whatever. And it was this amazing education that I didn't even realize at the time I was getting, this amazing education in the beats of a story and when people tune out, when they get bored, because kids will give you instant visual feedback when they are bored and they'll start getting into trouble and they're like rolling around. And, you know, I would find myself sometimes skipping. Well, not with the two. I just mentioned like Ellen Raskin and Lois Lowry, they were masters and never had to skip around in those. But, you know, certain authors where you're like, I'm going to skip these like seven pages where the forest is described in detail, like, or I'm going to summarize a little bit. I'll read three sentences and then we'll go on. It's not that kids have poor attention spans necessarily. And these kids were great, but those authors are writing in a vacuum without an audience of children literally sitting in front of them, rolling their eyes and getting out the craft scissors and starting to snip hems of their pants or whatever, you know. So it's like I got this feedback though, man. I could give you some notes based on the audience reception. That just, you know, that sunk in a way that I feel like I have a really, I'm grateful for the ability to, I think, you know, it's not like it's easy, but it sometimes works for me that I can feel when we need something new, when it's time for a revelation, when it's time for a turn, when it's been too long since something has happened. I just feel that really physically, viscerally, because I had, you know, this 12 years of training.
and it did allow you, I really loved that there were a bunch of short chapters in which Bodhi can theorize about different suspects and what they might have done and what the murder might have looked like. And of course, we're very used to seeing that in detective novels where partners are going back and forth. Well, if he did this, and it's so much neater to see it in one person's brain.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I wanted to just kind of take us there into various scenarios rather than trying to have that come out in dialogue or anything like that. This did not work at all, but I originally had all those sections together in the middle of the novel. So it's like you got through and then it was like, here's like seven different scenarios. And then we got the second part of the novel. It was not, didn't work. And I think that was early on. My editor was like, maybe, you know, think about doing something different with these. It made so much more sense to spread them out, partly because it's the order that she's really thinking through these things.
Yeah.
Different possibilities are occurring to her, but yeah, they, it also, you know, it's a way, but you know, this is a book where this is not a terrible spoiler. By the end of the book, you do pretty much know who did this and what happened. And, but, you know, I'm not going to have this moment where this person, it's an intentionally unsatisfying ending in some ways too, right? Mm-hmm, this person's mm-hmm. not going to be like, yes, and here's how I did it. but having had those chapters along the way with various scenarios playing out, my hope is that then when you do figure out what happened, you're able to go back to those other scenarios and be like, okay, like I have a good sense of what probably went down.
And of course, we're not just doing this with the murder. We're watching Bodhi do this with her time in high school overall, kind of figuring out these mysteries. And I find it so poignant that we all seem to be unreliable narrators, especially when we're trying to piece together our adolescence or our teenage years.
Yeah, yeah. It was really important to me that this was a book where we're trapped in the present. She thinks back on things that happened in high school, but we never go back there. We never, like, the narrative zooms us back there. And also, she's very honest with herself and, you know, with the audience of the book about the things she doesn't remember and the confusion she has. There's, you know, there's the suspension of disbelief that we often need going into a novel is that when someone has a memory, it's going to be like a full chronological three-page memory where like all the details, like I tasted the salad and then I put my hand down 50 years earlier, right? Which is not how memory works. It's how memory works in film. And I think what's happening in recent literary fiction is that people are borrowing from a filmic portrayal of memory rather than either a realistic human portrayal of memory or B, sort of a, you know, like someone like Virginia Woolf worked so hard to get across with just like examining human consciousness. Like we're not tapping into literary tradition. We're not tapping into actual human psychology. We're just writing down a movie and someone's in there in this memory and then they need to be like shaken out of it by someone calling their name. And then it's like, no, you need that in film to get out of the, you know, like to transition out of the sepia toned memory and back into the present scene. You don't need that in fiction. So, you know, I really wanted to trap us and to trap Bodhi in the present where these memories are really subjective and they're really unreliable. I've had several people ask me, call her an unreliable narrator. And I really disagree. I think she's a tremendously reliable narrator because she's being honest about this stuff versus narrators who are like, yes, I remember that day. Tuesday, it was 33 degrees.
And you can see that over the years, she's had some time to reflect back. And there are things she knows now that she certainly didn't know then.
Yeah.
And I mean, you do such a good job of encapsulating this relationship she had with this harasser, this other kid at school who just jokes, quote unquote, with her all the time. And that's stuff that she's already kind of like, I picture this scene of Bodhi, like, think, like reading about a case, like reading about a Me Too situation and being like, oh,
yeah. Well, I think that's what so many of us were going through with Me Too was this reckoning. It's like, we already knew what the big traumas, like, you know, people like having been assaulted and whatever. It's like, yeah, of course. But what was, not of course, but like that was already something that for most people, you know, you're aware this big, huge thing happened. But with Me Too, the excavation of these tiny moments was fascinating. And the things that I had not thought about in years and years and years, and, you know, that had maybe upset me at the time, but the narrative at the time is like, it's funny. Why aren't you laughing? If you don't find this funny, you're a prude or you're too uptight. And realizing, okay, no, that was actually a huge, like, I had every right to be upset. That was ridiculous. And other people were upset by things like that too. It's just that everyone was keeping quiet because no one wants to be the person going like, oh, put your dick back in your pants. You know,
that made me feel weird. And you get to get into that a little bit more with Jerome, who is Bodhi's separated husband, who his case kind of reminded me of the Aziz Ansari kind of like trying to figure out, like, what's the difference between bad behavior and meeting punishment?
Right. And it's fun. I think the Aziz Ansari situation, that was where for a lot of us, it kind of things kind of jumped the shark. We're like, okay, this is worth talking about for sure. It's not worth, like, you know, I wasn't there. I don't know. But, you know, the thing that's a seemed like a, just a very different scenario than, say, Matt Lauer or Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby, right? This is, you know, I wanted something messy, right? I don't want to go in there being like, yes, and now we're going to meet you, all these guys, and it's all for the best, because they're not always very clear-cut cases. And she, you know, she's looking at this case, and it's not like the book comes down one way or another, but the character's point of view is, he had a relationship that was a consensual adult relationship that didn't work out. And he didn't always treat her very well, but he didn't hit her. He didn't, you know, and now his career is going to be over because this woman has made an art piece about him, a performance art piece. And she messes things up further. So, you know, she gets into hot water. But this is some of the stuff, you know, in the art world, in the literature world, in film world, some of the things coming out are like, okay, people, there's, you know, there was a huge age gap, and these people dated consensually. Is that now suddenly a problem, you know? And someone can say, yeah, I was so young and naive, but okay, but if you were like, you know, 25, 28, or you were a consenting adult, are we going to say now that women in their 20s are not consenting adults? It just gets so messy.
And on the other hand, there is a power indifference. And the performance artist clearly has like a valid complaint against Jerome. And I wish more people would grapple with that kind of gray area rather than.
This is the thing, right? It's not right. This is not me saying we've gone too far. This is me like trying to get us into the grayest of gray areas. And just the book doesn't need to decide. The book doesn't need to be the jury on this, but what's, you know, what kind of things happen? And for Bodhi, she feels very, you know, protective of her husband and very indignant that this woman would accuse him of these things. But at the same time, she, you know, has this rage towards this young man who harassed her in school. And you think, well, but his wife would probably feel like, well, yeah, but he was a kid. And it's all a big mess. The thing is, you know, like Twitter or the internet, those are not places for the gray area. It's, you know, no one's going to come out on Twitter and be like, well, I don't know, it's complicated. And you, people try, but it's what gets amplified are the extreme positions. But what art, what literature can do is, you know, it has the space and the time to go into those gray areas and be like, hey, this is messy and paradoxical and there's no easy answer, but I'm going to tell a story about it.
I love that. And you do such a good job of the Greek chorus of Twitter responses.
Yeah. Oh, God. It's funny because, you know, like I obviously wrote this before the Elon Musk Twitter takeover. And that's like, you know, is this going to be some weird artifact of, you know, the brief life of Twitter if everything implodes? But no, those Twitter voices, I mean, they're easy to conjure, you know, because you see them, you see that all the time, the way people talk. And yeah, it was very fun. It was very fun to write tweets in a novel. I feel like I could have done that all day. I probably would have, I could have taken over the novel with tweets in a counterproductive way.
Well, then I appreciate your restraint. The book, I have some questions for you. It's amazing. Before we go, Rebecca, would you like to recommend some books for us, please?
Yeah. So I'm doing this thing right now. I'm reading my way around the world in translation. My father died in early 2020, and we weren't able to have a memorial for him, but he was among other things, a literary translator. And so I decided I'm just going to read my way around the world. He lived to be 84. So I'm doing around the world in 84 books. And I'm like tweeting about it and writing about it on my Substack and everything. So I have people reading with me. But the best one I've read so far in, I'm on book seven. I'm not very far, but the best book I read so far in that was The Door by Magda Szabo, Hungarian novel, Szabo. It is so good. It's about this woman's relationship with her housekeeper, house cleaner. But it's like this tense psychological drama that ends in like this horrible tragedy. It's really, really good. And then the last one I finished was called The Murderess. It's a Greek novella by Alexandros Papadiamantis. I think I'm saying that right. It's from like the early 1900s. It reads like a folk tale, but it's incredibly disturbing. It's this like town kind of witchy woman who just decides to mercy kill a lot of young, like female babies and children in the town, and then goes on the run. It's very weird. It's kind of like evil Baba Yaga sort of. Wow. I mean, I guess Baba Yaga's already supposed to be evil, but like a really evil Baba Yaga. So those are two highlights so far from my journey. Now I'm reading a Turkish novel. It's good so far, but I'm only like 10 pages in.
I love this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review. And check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.